Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer. We're a weekly public affairs conversation from KVON in Napa. On our program, we focus on the issues that matter to the people in the Napa Valley and in wine country, and occasionally look for stories you might not hear anywhere else or talked about in depth anywhere else. So thank you very much for joining us. On today's program, we're going to talk about our homeless neighbors in Napa County. And I have to say, I really do hate talking about the homeless, which is a thing. It's an anonymous object that's easy to ignore, easy to turn away from, easy to brush aside. There is an official count that puts our homeless population at about 323. But even the experts, like my guests today, will tell you that there are limitations to these kinds of surveys. So a couple of questions to think about for this conversation. The first is, how is it that people become homeless in the first place? I mean, what are their common themes? What are their human stories? Secondly, how successful are we in addressing and improving the housing situation, the larger issue? And why should affordable housing matter to people, even if they are themselves comfortably housed? Why should we care about this as a community issue? And finally, what do we still need to do, and how well are we doing it here in Napa? And I'm especially interested in this proposal that's being talked about to put a homeless funding initiative on the state ballot that Governor Newsom supports, that would put even more of an onus on cities and counties. So you'll be hearing from two experts who represent boots on the ground in addressing the challenges of homelessness and housing. And I'm looking forward to a great conversation. And speaking of great conversations, I hope you'll be part of our ongoing discussion. You can contact us on Twitter and Instagram at Deep Dive Show. You can also email us to deepdiveradio@winedownmedia.com. There you'll find, we'll post also on the website on kvon.com, interesting articles and things that we'll talk about in this conversation from our guests and from some of the research that we've done. But before we get to our conversation about housing and our homeless neighbors, I want to talk about another issue off the top, and that is the subject of district elections. It may not be well known, but there was a small but very significant article this week that talks about a development that will likely mean that the way people vote in the city of Napa will be very different by the time this November's election rolls around. And I'm not talking about people voting on whether or not we're going to change things. I'm talking about in November, the voters in Napa will be voting by district. At least it looks likely that that's going to happen. There is a group that has threatened to sue the city of Napa for violations of the Voting Rights Act, which is a pretty serious piece of legislation. Cities take Voting Rights Act violations very seriously. And this group is represented by a lawyer who handles these kinds of cases all over California. So where the city is right now, as I understand it, is it has a choice. It can settle this lawsuit by going to district elections immediately or pay a lot of money if it loses in court. And under California state law, the city of Napa can't recoup its attorney's fees, even if it wins. The plaintiffs can recoup attorney's fees, but even if cities win, then they are still liable for to be found by a court to be in violation of the Voting Rights Act. They can't recoup costs. And, you know, there's some pretty good documentation, which we'll post on the site, about how much money cities in California have paid after they've lost these kinds of challenges. City of Whittier, $1 million. City of Anaheim, $1.2 million. Modesto, $3 million. Palmdale, $4.7 million. You know, these are numbers that I'm sure the city fathers and mothers in Napa would like to avoid having to pay. So we'll do a program on district elections. I want to just put it on everybody's radar. And I have some questions that I think that I have and that I think people should be asking. The first one is that district elections are supposed to fix the problem of traditionally underrepresented communities like our Latino community, which is about 40% of the population of Napa and has had exactly one representative on the Napa City Council. There are none now. But is a district election really the best way to remedy that problem? Second question is, who's really behind this? You know, are these community leaders, are they in touch with people in the community, elected officials, business leaders, religious leaders, civic leaders? It's not clear to me that they've been out there talking to people. A lot of people I talk to, this comes as a real surprise. Third is, you know, Napa is a city that I will politely say acts very deliberately. Some would complain that it acts too slowly, but can it really pull off something as massive as a district election change by the time we hit the November elections? And just to be clear, this means that you as a voter will not be voting for your city council members, all of whom now run citywide. You'll be voting in a district. You will vote for one city council member. They will be your district city council member. Now, I have lived in cities which have districts, and I will tell you that what happens almost from the beginning is people stop taking the citywide point of view and start doing what's in the best interest of their district. I'll support a road project in your district if you'll give me, you know, sidewalk paving in mine, or you approve my hotel development. It happens. And I think it's, you know, it is. There's a real danger of that happening if we go to district elections here in Napa. So as I say, we'll do a show on this in the future as the issues become a little clearer. And we'll post on the website a couple of really good resources, one from the National League of Cities if you want to learn more about district versus at-large elections. We have at-large elections now. There's some interesting news coming out of the city of Davis, which is it's about 70,000. It's a little smaller than Napa, but comparable size, and they are moving very, very quickly to district elections. It's been a pretty controversial. It's really divided the elected officials over there, but they're moving quickly to do it there and at their school board. And as I say, you should take a look at the Register piece, which I'll put up, which talks about the district elections and where we are here in the city of Napa. Okay, so let's move ahead. As I say, I'd love to hear your thoughts on district elections or any other issues you think that we ought to be talking about on the show, guests we ought to be having on the show. You can drop us a note at deepdiveradio@winddownmedia.com or hit us up on Twitter or Instagram at deepdiveradio. Okay, now I would like to welcome our guests who have patiently listened to me talking. So our guests today are Cass Walker, who is the housing consultant for the Gasser Foundation here in Napa, and Molly Radigan, who is the director of housing and homeless services for the county of Napa. Cass, Molly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
So I dinged the Register last week because they covered this whole day city council retreat with a story about a 10-minute dust-up between two of the city council members and did not initially report all of the stuff that had been done for the previous 8 hours, one of which was the discussion of a citywide survey that Napa has done, which shows that housing is the number one issue, the number one concern here. It has become increasingly expensive to live in Napa. The city of Napa housing cost, average housing cost, $705,000 last year, literally twice what it was in 2012. So the rising prices affect affordability, but they also affect our homeless population. So I want to ask you, how are we doing? What are we doing? And is there reason for us to be hopeful that these issues are being tackled effectively?
Well, Larry, I think it's a time when homelessness and housing have been prioritized not only in our local community and by our city councils and board of supervisors, but it's gaining state attention and it's gaining national attention that housing is, especially housing that is affordable, is a crisis and it's something that is desperately needed, at least in California. And we're starting to see that the federal government is noticing that homelessness is particularly an issue in California, and that California has something close to, you know, nearly half of the nation's homeless population. And there's work that needs to be done. So I think by mere fact that it's becoming a priority for policymakers and being noticed by the federal government is a very good thing. But it doesn't mean that things can happen quickly. And as much as we work hard and have some great things and some great funding coming into Napa County and the city, which is where the majority of our homeless population in Napa County is, it still takes time and a thoughtful process to ensure that what we're doing is going to be most effective and right.
So, Cass, tell me about Gasser Foundation, your role, and what the role of kind of private philanthropy and community non-governmental organizations is in tackling this challenge.
Well, I think we're lucky to have the Gasser Foundation in our community because, first of all, we started off with some land where some of the most difficult housing can initially take place. So that was moving of the homeless shelter down to the South Napa Marketplace and the building of some transitional housing. But Gasser didn't stop there, knowing that there were other vulnerable populations in our community that needed housing, mostly the very low income. So we, as you know, just opened 50 units called Stoddard West. We received over 500 applications for that. We cut them off. We went through about 120 just to get our 50 tenants. So there's an incredible demand for housing for our workforce, and I think private philanthropy's role is to help move that forward, fill the funding gaps where they exist, where no designated state and federal funds do not cover the entire cost to keep the rents low for 55 or more years.
So how do we make up the shortfall? I mean, if the city has more of an obligation and will have even more of an obligation if this ballot initiative goes on and passes, how do we pay for it?
Well, I think what happens is, if you remember last year, the hospitality industry moved forward a sales tax.
A transient occupancy tax
of 1%.
Right.
To provide a funding source to help hospitality workers. I think other industries are finding ways to step forward to develop housing for their industry specifically and just to support other housing opportunities, but I think it's a larger need than that. For example, it took 12 different funding sources for Stoddard West, and looking at future projects, it's going to take that many, if not more, because you just have to layer the funding because it's expensive. Because when you're talking about rents that are a third of market rate for an extended period of time, for families that are earning, you know, less than $70,000 for moderate income, or for a very low income, less than $30,000 a year, it takes funding.
I think that's one of the biggest myths of affordable housing, which is just because it's affordable and the intent is to restrict the rent so that it is affordable to the individual or family that might be living in there, that it's affordable to build. And oftentimes, affordable housing can be as much to build, if not more cost-wise to build than market rate housing, for the reasons that Cass just mentioned. You have to go in planning knowing that for an extended period of time, usually somewhere between 40 to 55 years, your building a reserve up front for maintenance costs and supportive services or whatever else goes into that housing program. So we're finding in Napa, which is not inconsistent with the Bay Area, that, you know, each unit to build that you intend to designate as affordable can cost anywhere from $500,000 to upwards of $650,000. I'm sure San Francisco and Oakland have, higher rates than that, it's you're really looking at funding it for a 55-year term, not just building it to sell it.
So Daryl Steinberg, who's the mayor of Sacramento and, you know, kind of an acknowledged leader in homeless policy in California, says we need more housing choices that don't cost $500,000 a unit and take years to approve. Is that the norm?
I think that's the norm, but I think that's going to be quickly changing by some of the new legislation that Governor Newsom is putting in place. There was Assembly Bill 35 that now requires projects that have a certain percentage of affordability. They don't have to go through the CEQA process. The CEQA process is a $400,000, 6 months to a year delay.
Let's do a little pause to explain. So CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act. It was originally designed as an environmental protection measure to, among other things, to perhaps contain growth or runaway growth. But what has it turned into as far as building these kinds of housing units?
Well, from my perspective, it's turned into a lengthy delay, and it gives neighbors an opportunity that are NIMBYs to sue on a project that they don't want in their neighborhood. And what people are failing to realize is we're going to have affordable housing spread throughout our community, homeless housing spread throughout our community. That's what's happening. You know, publicly owned sites are now being designated for future affordable housing. So ways to stop projects in the past are being overcome, and I think people need to be receptive about, we need to be able to house all members of our community.
I want to talk about the whole NIMBY phenomenon in just a minute, because it affects more than the development of affordable housing. It affects commercial developments. It affects social service projects. I work with a number of organizations that are trying to develop really good things for the community that deal with mental health or substance abuse. And, people who live in the immediate neighborhood just don't want it there and want it somewhere else. Of course, that somewhere else is a mythical somewhere else, because find me a place that will welcome with open arms a mental health rehabilitation center or an affordable housing complex with no controversy. But let's pause on that one for just a second. You talked about new legislation. We also have legislation affecting things like ADUs. What's an ADU and a junior ADU? Why are they important in this conversation?
So ADU stands for accessory dwelling unit, and JADU is a junior accessory dwelling unit. And the JADU, the junior unit, is when you take a piece of your existing footprint of your home and convert a bedroom space into basically a standalone studio or one bedroom apartment.
Separate entrance kind of thing.
Separate entrance. It can have a shared bathroom, but it has to be isolated, locked from the rest of the house and have a separate entrance, and the ability to, sometimes you can use other pieces of the house, but you know, it's really a separate entrance and almost a standalone.
But it's part of the existing.
It's part of the existing footprint
residence.
And it's actually part of the existing, bedroom space. So you can't convert a garage, say, and call it a JADU. You have to convert a piece of a existing living
and make
space.
It essentially an apartment.
Correct.
With a separate entrance, locked entrance, privacy, that sort of thing.
Right. And they usually have what's called an efficiency kitchen, which is what you would consider, you know, a hot plate or an induction cooktop, and not necessarily a full stove, etc.
Like some of my early apartments with miniature refrigerators and two burners on the stove.
Exactly. And then an accessory dwelling unit is really where you convert non-living space or build a second unit on a property in your backyard. So it's really a complete standalone secondary living facility. Might have a full kitchen, might still have an efficiency kitchen, but it's really separate from the existing living space footprint that you have.
These are used to be, I think, known, now it's probably inappropriate to call them that, but they were granny units.
Granny units, right. Cottages.
Cottages.
Second
so
units.
You'd build a little cottage in your, or convert a garage into a living space on your property, and that would be accessible as a housing unit, perhaps a little bit more affordable for a single person to live in.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of state law has changed to require cities and counties to expedite permits or really define what could be taken into consideration when deciding whether or not to approve an ADU.
Or lower the cost.
Lower the cost. The cost is still a bit of a challenge in terms of if you're trying to deed restrict the unit to a lower income household. Again, there's been some work done at the state level about connection fees and things and whether or not you're establishing additional parking requirements and demands, et cetera. But I think that that's sort of the wave of what we're going to be looking at in the next year. I know the Community Foundation has really been engaged on the ADU, JADU concept and is working with its counterparts in Sonoma County to really put together a one-stop shop to assist landowners, property owners with filling out the paperwork, navigating the process, understanding what it's going to cost, how you go about building or considering whether or not your property is
and ultimately getting them online faster.
And I know that they're looking at some creative financing solutions as well. But I think that if you know, took properties in Napa County that have large backyards or the cities in the county, large backyards, extra space, et cetera, you really could do a lot of infill units that add to the housing stock.
I'm aware of people in the Bay Area who build these ADUs. You know, they have a nice piece of property. They build the ADU. They move out of the big house and into the ADU and then rent out the big house to some affluent family who can you know, afford to pay it. Obviously not a solution to homeless issue. But where does an ADU, how do you see that fitting into the, you know, kind of the complexion of a solution? Is it our best shot? Is it one of many things? What kind of stock are you putting in ADUs to deal with the homeless community in Napa?
I see it as one of many things. The more housing stock and opportunities you have, the more families and folks will move around to different opportunities and units. So it'll create any addition to the stock is a good stock. You know, we also at the county have a down payment assistance program, and the idea of helping someone move into home ownership frees up a rental unit. So I think any net new unit is positive for this community. Whether an ADU would be necessarily a solution to homelessness, hard to say. It's still a very new concept, but I think creating the additional unit might free up an apartment or another rental unit that becomes an opportunity for that. I will say, in terms of ADUs, JADUs in particular, both the city and the county have loan programs that help incentivize and forgive over time the cost of a loan to create that junior accessory dwelling unit so that the property owner receives some benefit of the income, the rent that comes from having that unit without necessarily incurring that cost, and it helps us place a lower income family or individual.
So where could people find out more about these assistance programs that you're talking about?
Sure. We will provide you the links if you'd like to place them on your site, but both the County of Napa website and the City of Napa website, countyofnapa.org and cityofnapa.org, have information on these programs, and we're happy to talk with you more about those opportunities.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, some people need help with the down payment. Some people need help. You know, they can make the down payment, but the monthly payments are a little high, or they won't qualify for those. So it's important to hit this issue kind of at every step of the home ownership process, or even the you know, finding a residence process.
And prevention is also very important, both from the homeless perspective, but also from as we start to see our community aging and we're facing what has been dubbed as a silver tsunami in individuals who are baby boomers and, you know, going to be leaving the workforce and living on fixed retirement.
Don't look at me when you're
income.
Talking about
Sorry.
This, please. You're staring at me.
I'll look at the wall.
Right. There I am. Right
you know,
there.
And so once you might own a home, but you might be living on a fixed income, and the idea of an accessory dwelling unit or a junior accessory dwelling unit helps you add to your income to maintain you in your home while creating another housing opportunity. So there's all sorts of opportunities to look at this solution creatively.
Let me take a step back. You guys, I refer to you as kind of boots on the ground in this battle. How did you get here? Give me a little bit of your own background, your own kind of professional journey. How did you wind up in this place?
Well, I was fortunate to work for the city of Napa for almost 20 years doing their downtown redevelopment and economic development work, and ended my career as their community development director. But after that, you know, I still wanted to do some good things, and so I got a call one day from Joe Peatman at the Gasser Foundation, who said, "We want to do some housing projects. Can you come over and talk to us?" And that's how I got started. It was about 4 or 5 years ago now. And that's been very rewarding to understand the political side of moving affordable housing forward, but also learning the private side and philanthropy associated with it. And,
mm-hmm. You know, so now you're acting as a consultant to this mm-hmm. very important local foundation.
And Gasser has funded me to learn a lot of information about housing, housing statistics, where we are compared to other communities, who our low income and vulnerable populations are, how that relates to our workforce and economic development and vitality of our business. We're to the point now that businesses cannot recruit employees because they can't find affordable housing here. So,
and we have evidence of that.
Right,
places closing, right? Well-known businesses, restaurants, and so on.
But it's starting to happen to the professional services sector because of the commute in, and then, you know, it's getting difficult, and the people can't find affordable housing that want to live here. There are discussions of moving, you know, entire business, you know, professional services like architects, engineers, those kinds of things.
Out of Napa.
Mm-hmm. And so that really starts affecting the vitality of our community. So it's a problem that we need to start really taking, you know, action steps.
We're going to take a short break. On the other side, we'll continue our conversation with Cass Walker and Molly Radigan about our homeless neighbors here in Napa, about affordable housing, what's getting in the way, the phenomenon of NIMBYism, which I can't wait to get your points of view on. So we'll be back right after this. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So just to set the, just to kind of reset the conversation.
You're not on.
Just to kind of reset the conversation. There is a homeless population in California of about 156,000, which is up 16% in the past year. Are we seeing similar kind of growth here locally?
We participate in a point in time count on an annual basis, which is a federal requirement. And while we have seen significant growth in California, Napa County has been a little bit more stable in their numbers. In 2017, from 2017 to 2018, we saw a small increase of about a dozen or so individuals in that point in time count. But between 2018 and 2019, we only saw actually an increase at that point in time count of one individual. In the coming days, we will be participating in the 2020 count process, and that'll give us some information as to what we're seeing.
So I talked earlier about the limitations of a point in time, a PIT count. What does it capture? What does it not capture? Is that really an accurate number? Are there really only 323 homeless people in all of Napa County?
So the purpose of a PIT count is really a way for the federal government and the state government, for that matter, to have a level playing field for determining what each jurisdiction's needs are. And when you have limited resources or whatever resources you do have, that PIT count is used to determine what percentage needs to go where and who has maybe a larger challenge that needs to be solved and how to provide the funding that might support that. It's not a perfect process. It's one 24-hour period in the last 10 days of January. Everybody does it.
The surveyors fan out to areas where we know or we think homeless people are living.
Correct. You're looking at who's in a shelter that night, and then you literally canvass in the middle of the night or early morning hours areas where people might be sleeping that are not meant for habitation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of who you can count when you are out. What I will say, we keep a lot of statistics here in Napa County, and so we know that our point-in-time count is about 323 people from 2019. We also know how many people are registered in our homeless management information system at any one time, and it's a similar number. It's in the low 300s on any given day. But we also track how many unduplicated individuals we serve in 1 year, and in 2019, that was about 1,000 unduplicated individuals. So that 1,000, you know, you're addressing and you're providing whatever support services they need to move them out as quickly as possible of the homeless situation. But I would say that for Napa County, the 323 is a pretty good representation of what we might be dealing with on any given day.
So who does it not count? Would it if someone is couch surfing in between residences, if somebody is living in a car that you don't, where you don't know where that person is, if somebody's living in somebody's garage, you wouldn't be able to count that because these pit counts are basically who you can eyeball basically on, at a given time.
So it's taking into account what we consider literally homeless or unsheltered homeless, individuals who might be sleeping in a place not meant for regular human habitation. So you're not going to capture someone who might be crashing on a friend's couch and moving from couch to couch, or, you know, staying on a living room floor of a family member, sleeping in a family member's garage, those sorts of things.
So the federal government views those people as somewhat housed.
Housed, sheltered, at least.
They're sheltered.
Right.
Okay.
So we're really looking at anyone who is sleeping in a public or private place that is not meant for human habitation, where you can see them visually outside, or they're in one of our emergency shelters here in the county.
Okay. So, Cass, you were talking earlier about how you've had to learn a lot, the kind of steep learning curve here. Give us a, help us paint a picture of how somebody typically goes from being sheltered to being homeless. What's that, what does that look like, and how, and what are some of the myths, I think, that, that people have about why people are homeless?
Well, I think one of it relates to the high cost of housing in this community and how what people are earning. So assuming you're living paycheck to paycheck and you have significant power outages and you don't get your normal pay, so you can't pay your rent, or you have a medical crisis, you break a leg, you twist an ankle, you have a manual labor job and you can't come to work for 2 weeks or a month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you may or may not have the right kind of insurance to deal with that.
The right kind of insurance. You don't. You have a family member who becomes ill and you have to move from a work environment to a caretaking environment. So those are sort of the social side of things. You have a dust up at work with your manager and you leave and then you're out for several weeks until you find another job. So you have those kind of normal, I think, everyday life experiences that happen, that someone that's living on a margin that doesn't have a lot of savings gets into a homeless situation, and the cities and the county have a lot of resources to help people, you know, fill in the rental gap, get rehoused quickly if they have a job, those kinds of things. But then there are other folks who have had life circumstances that hopefully none of us in this room ever experience, that have mental health crises, they turn to drugs or alcohol, and they their life becomes unstable. And so they move into homelessness. And when you're in a homelessness situation, how do you get clean and sober if you're just trying to get through the night?
Mm-hmm.
So there are other resources that we need to expend to help in those situations. So I don't think life is simple for anyone. And so when we start demonizing people that have had difficult circumstances and maybe not don't have the recovery mechanisms that we do, then I think we have to learn to be compassionate and figure out what is the right path for different people.
So is it a gross overgeneralization to say, for example, that people who are out on the street want to be there? They don't want to live inside. They want to live, you know, they have some preference for living out on the street.
I think that there are some people like that.
And probably.
That's their choice. But when you have 323 people, you know, the vast majority want to be housed. You know, they're seniors or they're, you know, transitioning youth from foster care. They're women that have come from battered situations. They're, you know, they're seniors who
running out of money or right.
get sick. Those are the people we really need to be focusing on housing.
I'm sure you saw the news of this kind of spectacle in Oakland over the last couple of weeks of these two homeless moms who occupied a house and in a very visible way were evicted with SWAT teams and cameras and everything else. What does that story tell us about kind of where we are on dealing with the homeless issue?
I think what it doesn't tell us is the incredible amount of work that goes in behind the scenes and what is called a coordinated entry system and a continuum of care in most communities. And I think one of the unique opportunities that Napa County has is that we're a smaller community and we work well together, and we have many engaged community service-based organizations and county and city organizations that really work together well to combat homelessness and to, as Cass was explaining, figure out the right intervention for each person. And so what I would offer to that is, I think it's really important for our community to know that, you know, between Queen of the Valley, many of our nonprofits, Buckaloo, I'm trying to think of Abode, Napa County, Napa City, we spend a lot of time together really working on what an individual who is experiencing or is at risk of experiencing homelessness needs, and that their needs might be different than Cass's needs might be different than my needs, and that you have to focus the intervention based on the person and not assume that everyone is exactly the same or needs the same type of intervention.
Cass, what did you make of that story? What were your thoughts as that drama unfolded? And what does it tell? Does it tell us much, or is it just kind of a spectacle?
Well, I might have a different perspective, but it talks about the vacant houses that we have around this community, the homes that are on VRBO or Airbnb, the wealthy people that have a second home that just sits there when we're clamoring for having housing. And so that, you know, told the story of a real estate company that had a vacant house. They hadn't transitioned it to something else.
They were flipping it.
They were going to flip that house. Someone came in. That's the desperate cry for families trying to find a shelter.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to own up to that, and we need to figure out, you know, how we manage our housing stock that we do have.
I talked to somebody last week, and I was talking about this program, and I said, you know, we're going to be talking about homelessness and how kind of proximate it is to perhaps more than we realize to people in our community or people in our families or even ourselves. And he said, yeah, I was homeless. This is a guy who's a professional guy, good job, adult children now. But he said, I got divorced and laid off at right about the same time. And he said, my kids and I were living out of our car for a while. He said, so, you know, homelessness to me is not this amorphous concept. It happens. It happened to me. So it's really, you know, Molly and I were talking about this before the show. It's important to be talking about this in human terms. We're talking about people and circumstances in their lives, some of which we have in our lives and survive, some of which they have in their lives and really suffer from. Now, so I said earlier, we're going to talk a little bit about this whole, the frustration of NIMBYism. What is NIMBYism, and why is it an obstacle to building more affordable housing here in Napa?
Well, I'm going to have a slightly different perspective on what.
Well, you're an official.
People label as NIMBYism, yes. And you know, I think what it truly is. I don't always love the term NIMBY, which means not in my backyard, and I think that as a public official, our role is to hear both sides, and our role is to help come and mediate conflicts or figure out the best solution to solving our housing problem, but being cognizant of those that might be living in a situation where something new is coming in or it's unknown, and how to help navigate that change. I think that one of the biggest, what I think is not known is that we're already housing formerly homeless or those exiting the homeless situation throughout this community. We're doing it in what's called a scattered site model. And, you know, you very well may have somebody who has left homelessness that might have substance abuse issues or mental health issues and whatnot living next door to you, and you just don't know it. And that's our goal, is we want to place individuals in housing and the most appropriate housing intervention for them and provide them those supportive services so that they're not a burden on their neighbors and that everybody can live harmoniously and you know, feel safe in their neighborhood. So that is our ultimate goal, is to work with neighbors who have concerns about projects that might be coming to their neighborhood or individuals who might be placed in their neighborhood in existing housing units, to ensure that they also have resources so that we can make this housing opportunity successful, not just for those neighbors, but for the person who's being placed there as well. Our system does not work if we are not available to provide the resources to anyone who needs the resources and assistance to navigate the changing situation.
I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, this woman is so incredibly tactful. When I talk to people, and I deal with this in my professional life, you know, who run up against these NIMBY, but not in my backyard, challenges, it's usually not so intellectual. It's usually a lot more emotional. You know, the folks in the neighborhood feel like they haven't been consulted, or that what's being imposed on them is really terrible, that they're being asked to make a sacrifice, that their property values are going to go down. I dealt with a NIMBY struggle on the peninsula for a school district that wanted to reopen a school that had been shuttered for many years, but their population was growing. And the neighbors, they didn't want it. They didn't want kids walking through their neighborhood. And they filed a lawsuit to stop this school, which took a year and cost the district like $1 million. And the district ultimately won. They ultimately opened that school. But I thought, this is just ridiculous, you know, that you could cause such delays and such problems. I can only imagine when you're dealing with more controversial things like housing or affordable housing or homeless, you're going to run into that a lot more. So you're involved in a particular issue right now. Maybe you should tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Gasser Foundation and Burbank Housing and Abode Services are trying to move forward on a project near the Queen of the Valley Hospital that would be partially affordable housing, and then there would be 33 units for the formerly homeless. And, you know, it has generated a lot of fear and concern in the neighborhood. And we've been trying to meet with neighbors, provide tours of similar facilities in other communities, and talk through the, you know, what their fear is based on, and putting in some mechanisms to try and help address those fears. I think it's difficult when fear starts driving our decisions and we lose our compassion. There's always going to be this concern about when you bring in affordable housing, you're going to lose your property values. But that has proven not to be correct in Napa and around the country. You know, a project like this.
And I think courts take a pretty dim view on that as an argument, right, in lawsuits.
When you start bringing upwards of $60 to $70 million into a neighborhood, that's, in my book, revitalization.
Mm-hmm.
And the concern that you have increased crime, that has also proved not to be true. So, you know, is it then our perceptions of we're concerned that it may be a homeless person or someone that isn't from our economic class or our social class that will be in my neighborhood that I don't know? Now, that's something that's more difficult to address, is your personal concerns. But Napa is a low crime, you know, very healthy community, and having homeless individuals, you know, living along our creek beds or families living in cars, that it doesn't relate to the overall health of the community. Mm-hmm. So I think that's more of a concern that needs to be addressed.
Well, and are we just a step away from the situation that we see over in Sonoma County, where an entire walking and hiking trail is now lined with homeless encampments, right? It's a very visual, visceral picture, you know, that has kind of riveted attention over there onto the homeless issue and made it a real conversation piece in the Bay Area, right? We don't just talk about Oakland and San Francisco anymore. We go right to those pictures of the Joe Rodota Trail.
Well, I think we have to remember that, you know, housing is one of the most significant solutions to homelessness. It's not the only solution. You know, there are services and things that come with that. But if we truly, as a community, want to combat, eradicate, eliminate homelessness, you know, housing is going to be a big piece of that. And whether as a community we want to do that or not, you know, the state of California, Governor Newsom, has made it an incredible priority and one of his key policy issues. And so cities and counties at some point are going to be, you know, forced, whether they want to or not, to comply with state policies and maybe even federal policies around the public health issue that comes with having large amounts of homelessness and people living in places not meant for human habitation. So I think that, you know, from the policy perspective side and being a government official, one of the things we have to do is have these very thoughtful conversations with our community, with our neighbors, with our partners, and figure out what those solutions look like and how we can help balance that emotion and that change is scary and that the fear of the unknown is very difficult to tackle and create a community and a solution for our community that works for us. It might not be the same as what works in San Francisco. It might not be the same as what works in Sacramento, but we need to thoughtfully think about what we can do here in Napa to create the community that we want to create.
I'm thinking of a situation that I was involved with many years ago, trying to open up a mental health rehabilitation center in a residential community, which is where people do best, right, in those kinds of facilities. You know, oftentimes you hear, I really support fill in the blank, mental health services, homeless services, but this just isn't the right neighborhood for it. Unfortunately, the sides got drawn, lawyers got to work, and the only way this ultimately happened is that our side beat their side, basically, with threat of lawsuits, bad PR, political pressure. Now, the irony is one of the neighborhood stores, a liquor store, took our manager's business card and taped it on the cash register and said, if there's one incident over there, I'm calling you and your thing is right here. She went back there 15 years later and the tape had yellowed. He had never had to use the phone. He'd never had to make a call because there wasn't an incident. Just as we had said, there's unlikely to be any incidents. So a lot of this is fear-based, and I imagine a lot of it is exacerbated by the tenor of our political times, where we're just so ready to question the other person's motives rather than their arguments. Does that make it more difficult?
I think that doesn't help. I think that we're getting into a more confrontational, strident discussion as opposed to sitting around a table and having a conversation and developing solutions. So I think that is changing. I think part of it is incumbent upon people like Molly and myself to do better education and be out there trying to inform the community more about the need for housing, who that relates to in our community in terms of workforce and homelessness, seniors, people that have medical disabilities. The demographics of a homeless person are varied. And I think we need to start communicating that as well as what are all the solutions.
Well, interesting for those of us in the communication business. If you could wave the magic wand and change the conversation, how would it change? I talked earlier about how I hate the use of the term the homeless because it sounds like, you know, a nuisance, just a nuisance.
Well, when you think, you know, 45% of our homeless have been residents for 10 years, 30% have been residents for over 20 years. These are our residents who just aren't sheltered.
Or you could even say these are people who help sustain and build this community in their time here, right? They're not just sponging, you know, they didn't just happen to live here. My guess is a lot of those folks, you know, made significant contributions or to their schools or their churches or their little leagues, right?
And I think that's true. I think you brought up sort of what's happening in Santa Rosa, and I think, you know, Napa's to be complemented because we are making strides. We don't have situations like that. We're trying to move the needle on this as quickly as we can with access to resources, getting housing built, so we don't run into that situation. So yes, we have blue tarps around the community. Yes, we have some people living in unsheltered places along the river, but not to the extent you see in other communities, and that's because we are trying to make a change.
What is it, since we're about to hit time here, what is it that people who are listening to this and wondering, what can I do? You know, can I make any kind of a difference here? Or is this basically all a question of what governments and big foundations can do? What would you tell them?
I think that government can't be the answer and end-all be-all 100% solution to this challenge. I think it's going to take creative solutions and thoughtful discussions. And, you know, where there is concern, those concerns need to be expressed and need to find those compromises or those ways to mitigate those concerns. Because as I think Cass mentioned, you know, we have one project that's out right now, but that's going to be the first of many based on funding that's coming down and mandates that are coming down from the state. So we really need to thoughtfully think of the community as how we talk about homelessness and how we engage in thoughtful discussions to ensure that we are providing a solution to those who may be experiencing homelessness or at risk of experiencing homelessness.
So you, if people wanted to look at resources from Napa County, where would they go?
Our county website has information on our resources, countyofnapa.org, and also Abode Services, and we can get you the links for the websites of how you can contribute to our local system if you choose to as a volunteer or if you have items to donate, et cetera.
Great. Cass, same question to you. How can the individual get involved, or if I have a church organization or a local community organization, what can they actually do to be hands-on on this issue?
I think a recent example is Common Ground and the Interfaith Council brought an education opportunity, which was a film called The Invisible Guest. Mm-hmm. And so it was aired locally to give people better background. So I think helping with the education process is important.
I want to thank you both for being here. This hour has gone by very, very quickly. Again, Cass Walker, the Gasser Foundation Housing Consultant, and Molly Radigan, the Director of Housing and Homeless Services here in Napa County. I encourage you to go back to the KVON website. We'll post a lot of the information that we're talking about here, where you can dive a little deeper and learn a little bit more. On next week's program, we're going to be talking about agriculture and the future of agriculture here in the Napa Valley. We have what some people would say is kind of a monoculture, heavily dependent on one crop, Cabernet grapes. How sustainable is that crop in the looking at the future of global warming? What are the steps that are being taken to deal with environmental and water issues? And what about the prospect of cannabis coming here to Napa County, which is a very real thing? So that'll be next week on The Deep Dive. I want to thank you all for joining us. I'm Larry Kamer, and this is The Deep Dive.